together now. This is Charlene Spretnak. If you listen to this program regularly, you're aware of 350.org. That's a climate activism organization. It takes its name from 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is the level, according to the climate scientist James Hansen, we need to return to in order to have a planet that resembles the one we've known. And you've probably also heard in the media this past week that the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is expected to reach within the next few days 400 parts per million. We've been inching up to that, way above the 350 target. This ominous milestone is unprecedented in human history. The atmosphere of the Earth hasn't contained that much carbon dioxide since the Pliocene epoch, which ended more than 200 million years before our species even emerged. And these measurements of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere come from the United States government's Earth System Research Lab in Hawaii. It's called the Mauna Loa Observatory, and it's located on top of a volcanic mountain that's more than 11,000 feet above sea level. So the data from this observatory is considered the gold standard in carbon dioxide measurements because of its isolation from major pollution sources and also because it has a long record of measurements. So the levels of carbon dioxide do fluctuate seasonally during the year, and they typically peak this month around mid-May at Mauna Loa. Now, global carbon dioxide levels had hovered between 170 parts per million and up to 300 parts per million sometimes for thousands of centuries until the Industrial Revolution, which started first in England around the late 18th century, say 1790 or so before that. And it's calculated that the level of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere at that time when the Industrial Revolution started was probably about 280 parts per million. And then it immediately started to climb decade by decade, to skyrocket really. And by 1958, it had reached 317 parts per million, and that's when the Mauna Loa Observatory was established. And then by the end of the last century, year 2000, it was up to 360 parts per million. So I saw one news report on the internet this morning that said that the 400 parts per million level of carbon dioxide had now been recorded for one full day, not just parts of a day, at the Mauna Loa Observatory. But I couldn't find corroboration of that report on the NOAA site, so perhaps the ominous threshold will not be reached until tomorrow or the next day or the next day. But the point is that any fool should be able to realize that changing the atmosphere of our planet so drastically from 280 parts per carbon dioxide before the Industrial Revolution to 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide now, it's severely disrupting the cycles and patterns of life on Earth. And certainly all the extreme weather events worldwide bear witness to the fact that we are already well into global climate disruption. We've seen this coming at least since 1988, when James Hansen, the climate scientist, testified before Congress, and he laid it all out. Yet, maddeningly, we did not see, since then, any rational, across-the-board effort similar to the rapid mobilization of the whole economy as soon as we entered World War II, for instance. Nothing like that. No effort to substitute renewable resources for the burning of fossil fuels, which contribute 80% of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We didn't see a big push to get solar panels installed on the roof of every home and building in our country. Why? Well, as Richard Heinberg explained on the program a few weeks ago, the electricity in the grid is designed for one-way flow. So the utility plants can't really handle too much backflow of excess electricity that would flow from home roof panels back into the utility. All right. And we have not seen a carbon tax in this country, even though Ireland has had a huge success with theirs in the last year and a half, with the new revenue that they got really helping them with their economic recovery. We haven't even seen a clear no from our government on the XL pipeline, which would make possible the highly polluting excavation of oil embedded in the tar sands of Alberta, only to be transported across our country to Port Arthur, Texas, so it can be exported, sold, somebody makes some profits, and burned to add significantly to the rising level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's absolutely crazy-making what is not happening as a rational response to the climate change crisis. Of course, some good things are happening, such as 350.org's divestment campaign, which is succeeding in getting municipal governments and universities to look at their investment portfolios and sell all their stock that they hold in fossil fuel corporations, who have done so much to pressure governments to do nearly nothing about the climate change crisis. But something else is happening in this area as well that we have not heard much about. This is a so-called technological fix. It's always called in to address destruction from technological devastation, and yet it's a fix that nearly always makes the situation worse through unintended consequences, or more properly, unadvertised consequences. The dangers are always apparent to anyone willing to take a serious look and to think with a frame of reference that pays attention to dynamic interrelatedness, which is the theme of this program. Today we're going to hear about two such technological fixes, geoengineering and synthetic biology. My guest today is Pat Mooney. He has more than four decades of experience in working with international civil society. He's widely recognized as an authority on issues of global governance, corporate concentration, and intellectual property monopoly. Pat Mooney is the co-founder and executive director of a nonprofit civil society organization that is now called ETC Group. ETC Group, which is headquartered in Ottawa, has offices in the United States, Mexico, and the Philippines. They work with partners to address broad ecological and technological issues facing marginalized people, primarily in the Global South. ETC Group was the first civil society organization to address the politics of seeds, that is, the genetic erosion of plant genetic diversity through industrial agriculture, corporate concentration, and intellectual property monopoly in the 1970s. They created an intergovernmental commission in the 1980s and were part of the push to get the UN treaty in 2004. ETC Group has often been the first activist group to challenge many so-called technological fixes that actually have had destructive effects at the grassroots level, including in recent years geoengineering and synthetic biology. Pat Mooney is the author of Seeds of the Earth, a private or public resource. And he's the co-author of Shattering, food, politics, and the loss of genetic diversity. In 1985, he received the Right Livelihood Award on behalf of the ETC Group. Pat Mooney, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I must admit that I was pretty much dumbfounded back in early March when I was at a conference on techno-utopia, a critical conference on techno-utopia, and I listened to the presentation you made about geoengineering and synthetic biology, and although I consider myself a pretty well-informed person, just about everything you conveyed was news to me. So I'd like to start today with geoengineering and ask you to define it for the listeners and then explain how it's being touted as a terribly clever response to global climate change.
Sure. I'm not surprised that you hadn't heard about it. It's really something which has come up very quickly in the last 4 or 5 years, and it's now being debated much more in the United Nations and around some national governments around the world. But I'm afraid you are going to hear more about it in the years ahead. Geoengineering by the United Nations is described as some effort to adjust planetary systems in order to respond to climate change. So the kind of planetary system adjustments that are most commonly talked about are doing something to the surface of the ocean so that it can sequester more greenhouse gas emissions, or doing something to the stratosphere to block sunlight, to lower temperatures, to control, again, greenhouse gases. So there are huge kinds of ideas of, you know, the surface of the ocean,
yikes,
the sky above us, to manipulate these to at least buy time, as governments try to do what they should have done decades ago,
yeah,
about climate change.
But wouldn't sequestering carbon dioxide in the surfaces of the ocean kill off the plankton and the other necessary life forms?
Well, no one's quite sure what it would do, actually. Since 1993, there have been a dozen different intergovernmental experiments trying this theory out. And the theory is, on the surface of it, it seems straightforward and quite credible. You dump iron filings on the surface of the ocean, even nanoparticle filings of iron, and that creates a nutrient base for phytoplankton. So the phytoplankton absorb the iron filings and grow, benefit from that. So there's more phytoplankton. Then when the phytoplankton dies, it takes the carbon dioxide it's absorbed from the atmosphere as well and sinks to the bottom of the ocean. So all of that carbon dioxide that we're concerned about is in Davy Jones' locker. That's the theory. The reality has been that in a dozen international experiments, it hasn't ever worked. At the best, governments have concluded saying, well, you know, we're not quite sure what happened there, or, well, maybe we need to have a bigger experiment. So we've had experiments already that have been like 10,000 square kilometers of ocean being tested at one time, and they still can't prove that it actually does work. So I think the overwhelming opinion of most oceanographers and marine biologists and so on is that it really doesn't work. But it doesn't stop, unfortunately, a lot of private companies now from getting on the bandwagon, saying that they can sell carbon credits by offering to absorb this carbon dioxide and convincing gullible people and airlines and companies to say that they're offsetting their carbon footprint by doing ocean fertilization experiments. So it carries on, even though it has very little scientific credibility anywhere any longer.
Well, wasn't there a story in the media about some wealthy man who privately went out and dumped a bunch of iron pellets in the Pacific?
Well, he's not as wealthy as he used to be, I don't think. This happened last year. It really took us all by surprise because since 2008, there's been a moratorium against ocean fertilization established at the United Nations through its Convention on Biological Diversity. So that's in place, and it was actually reaffirmed by the heads of state meeting that took place in Rio de Janeiro last summer. So there's a very strong international view on how bad ocean fertilization can be. But this one character, his name is Russell George, has a private company that he had tried some years ago to do a sort of a dump of iron particles off the coast of Ecuador, and then again near the Canary Islands in the Atlantic Ocean, and each time had been stopped from doing it. But he convinced a really wonderful group of people, the Aboriginal community of the Haida Gwaii in around the Queen Charlotte Islands, as they're called, in the west, the Pacific coast of Canada.
Uh-huh.
He went to them, got them to believe, or some of them to believe, that doing an ocean fertilization experiment would restore their salmon stock, which has been eroding over the decades, and would also get them carbon credits. And they took out a loan of $2.5 million from the local credit union to finance this. They went ahead and did it. It was months after they'd done it, before anyone actually realized that it happened, when satellites picked up this huge bloom of phytoplankton in the oceans. And we're still not quite sure what the effect of it was. There's simply no proof that anything good happened, and there's some concern that there's been some contaminations along the shoreline because of it since that happened. The company is threatening to do it again a second time, but as they've been threatening that, the Canadian government, much to my surprise, I must say, our Canadian government is not responding to climate change. You know, these are the tar sands guys. And but they actually, even they, the Minister of Environment, said this is an illegal action, and they raided the offices of the company just back in March. And we hope that this will prevent the company from, again, threatening the oceans the way they did last year. Meanwhile, I should say the Haida Gwaii are really, I think, horrified by what happened and feel like they've been taken for a ride.
So I want to use this opportunity to ask you some questions. I was taking notes so quickly, and your presentation was brief back at the Techno-Utopia conference. But so ocean seeding means the same thing as ocean fertilization. It means putting those iron pellets out?
Yes, it doesn't have to be iron, but there are areas of the ocean that are without iron, you know, nutrients. And so the theory is that if you go to those areas and dump the iron, that this will have some benefit to phytoplankton. But there's also urea dumps that have been done or tried to be done off the coast of the Philippines and Morocco and Australia at different times. Those also have either been stopped or they haven't, again, borne any fruit that anyone can suggest is helpful to anybody.
Yeah.
Certainly not to the climate.
And then when you say there's a moratorium through the United Nations against this ocean seeding or ocean fertilization, so-called, but it's not a ban. What's the difference between a moratorium and a ban?
Well, getting a ban is really hard to do. Getting a moratorium means that the 193 governments that are part of the Convention on Biological Diversity have agreed together that no one should do these kinds of experiments until there's other scientific information that might suggest at some point in the future that this could have a purpose of some kind. So the moratorium is quite strong, though. It says that you can do experimentation on a very small scale in your own national waters, in your own coastal waters. You can't do anything out in the open seas, and whatever you do, it shouldn't be large, and it also should not be commercial. It shouldn't be a scientific experiment to make money. So that's all in place, and that's why I think it is that even our Minister of the Environment here in Canada was prepared to say that this was what happened in off the coast of British Columbia broke the law.
I'm sorry to hear what you said about the Canadian government, which is usually the white hat guy. So many things they've done right in the past, including the Canadian banks just saying we wouldn't touch those securitized mortgage scams with a 10-foot pole. I think only the banks in Lebanon and Canada didn't go for that global scam. But, I mean, a lot of, not only that's a private decision, of course, but governmental decisions have been admirable. So is there at least some split on this in the government now, or?
Well, I mean, the government is at least at this point saying that they feel an obligation under the United Nations to protect the oceans, and so they are taking action against this company.
But don't they feel with the tar sands? They don't feel the same obligation to protect the atmosphere?
No, I don't think they do at all. I think that's profitable for them. I mean, the difference, I guess, is that by all definitions, ocean fertilization is a dangerous and dumb idea that makes no money, whereas the tar sands are a dangerous and dumb idea that makes money.
I see. Well, that does get their attention, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, now how about this other kind of geoengineering? You mentioned at
the
beginning of your response here, they're going to somehow thicken up the thinning ozone so that less solar radiation would reach us?
Exactly. I mean, I guess the model that everyone refers to is what happened in 1991 when Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty major eruption, and it it blew an awful lot of gunk into the stratosphere, mainly sulfates, that stayed aloft for a couple of years because they're very light and they went up very high. It takes a long time to come down again. And that cover of dust, basically, up in the stratosphere blocked sunlight. And so temperatures were lowered, and depending on who you talked to and where you were, anywhere from, you know, a third of a degree to almost a degree and a half of temperature during the course of those 2 years. And that was, that gave everybody the idea that, well, you know, we could actually have artificial volcanoes, pipes that you have on the ground that, that blow sulfates continuously into the stratosphere up to around, you're talking about something around 20 kilometers in the air or 30 kilometers in the air even, and keep it blowing so you have a permanent sort of haze in the sky that again keeps the temperatures lower. And that, the benefit of that is seen that, that then you don't get the worst effects of the greenhouse gas emissions. You stop some of the shock impacts that are happening on the ground, kind of. You don't do anything, however, about cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions that way. You don't end the problem. You simply postpone it. The moment you stop blowing sulfates into the stratosphere, the buildup that's been caused just shoots up again. The temperatures shoot up again, and you're back to where you were before, except for in spades, in much worse situation than you might have been if you'd tried to do something about mitigating the problem in the first place.
Well, that seems very obvious. Why don't governments say to these companies, as soon as you would stop, da-da-da-da-da would happen?
Well, it's not companies in this case. It really is mostly governments talking about it. Your government, the United States, the UK government has been very aggressive in looking into options for this. The Canadian government, I think, is definitely interested in it. The Russians and the Chinese are interested. Many other countries, the Germans included, are actually looking at the possibility as well. What's attractive about solar radiation management is it does work. I mean, you do temporarily get rid of some of the symptoms of the disease. And secondly, it's really quite cheap. So compared to greening your economy in a real way, cutting back on the emissions and transforming manufacturing, you really can do this for almost nothing by comparison, a few billion dollars a year. And it happens relatively quickly. So you can actually blow this, you know, set this stuff up and blow it into the stratosphere, and you've got something that starts to work for you in a few months. And that's very attractive to governments who haven't had the courage to even tell their people to take the bus, you know, to do something about climate change.
I guess that would be a nice way out. Oh, dear. Yeah, so much that hasn't been done. Okay, what about their ideas on weather modification?
We see that as part of it. I mean, we've had more than a half a century, we've probably had closer to a century of people trying to modify the weather with airplanes and everything else to create rain in one place or another. The most famous examples were under the Johnson administration in the United States in the 1960s when there was a famine in Bihar in India. Lyndon Johnson proposed that they try to use the U.S. Air Force to modify the weather over Bihar to cause rain. Didn't work.
But they call it cloud seeding, right?
Yes, cloud seeding, but on a massive scale. I mean, you're talking about, you're not just trying to keep the rain on or off your picnic, you're really trying to affect a subcontinent. And even though it didn't work in the case of Bihar, Nixon picked up on the idea from Johnson and thought that would be a nice thing to try out in during the Vietnam War to sort of flood the trail, you know, the Mekong Trail coming down from North Vietnam, and to flood rice paddies as well to cause hunger in North Vietnam. And so that was tried. It was called Operation Popeye. And it, again, there's no one can be clear whether it works or not. It's always kind of hard to know whether or not, you know, what the rain that came was because of something you did or not. So the debate is still open as to whether it worked. But it again encouraged governments to think, well, this might be possible. So another experiment was done over the Philippines a few years later. And again, no evidence for sure that it really worked. There certainly were floods and hurricanes and so on that were caused, that happened. Whether they were caused by this or not, again, I don't know. But it's been going on, and the International Meteorological Organization in the United Nations has asked governments to keep up a roster of these kinds of cloud seeding weather modification experiments. And there's literally every year, you know, a dozen or more countries that try it out, from Thailand to Mexico to you know, everywhere, just every part of the world. In the United States, quite consistently, it's been happening in Canada as well. But again, the thought is that maybe that could be scaled up again to be a kind of solar radiation management. That's what it's always called. But we don't know that it's going to work. What we do know is that it's a great cop-out. It really lets a cowardly government say to its population, don't worry, folks, we got you covered. We don't have to do anything else. All we got to do is blow sulfates into the stratosphere, and we'll get rid of the... We'll get by the next election, at least. I mean, maybe nothing
exactly.
else, but at least we'll get through the election.
Yeah.
What scares us, quite honestly, is that some very decent scientists who are skilled and capable and honorable are taking it up, and they're taking it up on the assumption that, well, our governments are doing so badly, we have no choice but to have this as a kind of a plan B. We just got to be prepared for it. Hmm. And our feeling about that is the opposite. It really is that this can only be done by those big governments who've caused the problem in the first place, and haven't done anything about it. So we give them the option, no matter how sincere the scientists are, they won't be listened to. It becomes a political football that the governments will use as they wish to not do what they should do.
Yeah.
So leaving that option open even means that nothing really proper will get done. And with solar radiation management, again, you don't ever solve the problem by doing that. You simply delay and they ultimately exacerbate the really bad effects that will happen.
Yeah. You know, I used to be very angry at the climate scientists who, after James Hansen gave his initial testimony to Congress in 1988, were interviewed in the media, and they said, oh, yes, we've seen this coming for decades. So-and-so predicted this at the beginning of the 20th century, and we've been charting this extreme rise. I thought, you know, why didn't you say anything?
Because,
I mean, their training is such that, you know, they sort of feel they're hired public servants or in the private sector, but they don't see themselves as citizens who have a responsibility, you know, because they have privileged information to get it out there, to have 50 press conferences during the 70s and 80s and 90s. And so I used to think that way, but now that all the major scientific organizations of our planet have come out so clearly against what's happening with the CO2 levels and what the damage that is causing and you know what all the ramifications are, and still the corporations are able to wipe all that off the table and say, don't pay attention to those people, they're just saying that because they want research grants and they're building their careers. And so I see that no matter what the scientists and engineers would say, that corporate sector, especially in our country where every elected official, beyond the local level, absolutely has to go currying favor with the corporate donors and the wealthy individuals. And every vote is skewed because they can't offend those people because they need to get the big money to run again next time. And both parties give them a target. Everyone in Congress has to hit a certain money target every month of fundraising from the corporation, their lobbyists, and the wealthy individuals. So that's why we don't get any of the votes that would obviously be necessary in a democracy. But it's just been maddening how successful they've been in just moving all this aside as some little extremist whining.
Yeah, well, this is, I think it's less, I mean, there's not corporate profit to be made in promoting geoengineering, but there are savings to be made if you don't have to do anything else to change your manufacturing practices.
Right.
And that's probably the thing that attracts these companies the most. But they're not so much doing it themselves, because at the end of the day, if you're going to put pipes in the ground that are going to blow sulfates into the stratosphere, it's multi-billions of dollars still. And since you're going to affect everybody's climate everywhere in the world, it becomes a political issue and it becomes a military issue very quickly. So governments will be the ones that do it finally. And that, our worry is that they will do it. They will at a certain stage say, we have no choice but to go ahead and do this, and then they put us at risk. And we're getting some quite amazing arguments coming from some of the scientists and some of the governments now who are saying that, well, we don't really need to change the climate for the planet. We'll just do it over North America, or we'll do it just over the United States, or we'll just change the climate over the polar ice cap. And of course, you know, that's not the way the world works. We should know anything about planetary systems. They are planetary. Yeah.
Speaking of dynamic interrelatedness,
exactly.
The way reality is structured, well, that's a good point on which we will pause now for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Pat Mooney of the ETC Group in Ottawa. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Pat Mooney, of the ETC Group in Ottawa. Their extremely interesting and information-rich website is etcgroup.org. And, by the way, if you're wondering what ETC stands for in their name, here it is. E is for erosion of soil, of biodiversity, and cultural diversity. So they're on top of that. T is for technology, as we've heard, tracking nefarious new developments in technology. And C is for concentration, that is monitoring the concentrations of corporate and governmental power. And again, their website, which has links to partner sites in Spanish language and French language presentations, the website address, etcgroup.org. So, Pat Mooney, let's move into this second subject, synthetic biology. Again, I had no idea what was really going on in this area.
Yeah.
So can you define that for the listeners and give us a heads up here?
Sure. It's really extreme genetic engineering. It's way beyond genetically modified crops or genetically engineered crops as we've got to know them over the last 15 or 20 years. Instead of, like, the difference, I guess, is that, and it's not just related to agriculture, it can relate to health, you know, medicines and other areas as well, but mostly it's around agriculture, and the difference between synthetic biology and genetic engineering is that with genetic engineering, we normally move a gene from one species to another, one at a time, kind of, a very slow and clumsy and actually doesn't work very well for lots of good reasons. But with synthetic biology, instead of moving genes around, you're actually building your own DNA from the bottom up.
Oh,
so you're taking the base pairs of DNA and putting them together through machines called gene synthesizers that you can buy on eBay for a few $100s. They don't work very fast, but they're there.
Mm.
And you construct exactly the kind of species that you want to have. So you can take the template of a rice plant or a rose, and you can have that on your laptop, and then you can instruct your gene synthesizing machine to build you base pairs that are just somewhat different, so that you can add qualities or characteristics to the rose or to the rice crop that wouldn't exist in nature otherwise. You can also build your own microbes, and that's what's perhaps the most important and perhaps the most dangerous part of this technology as well, is that you can say, well, this is a microbe that's very good at gobbling up sugars in trees or crops or something, but it's not good at gobbling up the cellulosic fiber of a tree. If we can tweak it, adjust its DNA a bit so that it can chew on cellulose and convert that into sugars, then we can make lots of money. And so the objective is to really develop these kinds of microbes that you can put into a vat in a factory, in a closed lab system in a way, and then you can pump into the factory whatever biological materials you want to, whatever biomass you want to use, trees or sugarcane or corn or soybeans or whatever, and decide when it's there whether or not you want these microbes to build you food or pharmaceuticals or biofuels or plastics or something else. You can make that decision at the end of the process, almost, it seems. And that's...
Holy Toledo. Is this the same thing as the little nano machines that would say eat sugar or eat iron? I'm thinking of a friend of a neighbor of mine. We were taking a walk, and he was a techie guy, and he was talking about those little machines, for instance, that You want
nanobots
to deoxidize.
Yeah, yeah.
Suppose something's rusted. You want it to not be oxidized. So they can eat all the iron off the surface. And he said, but then there's the persistence problem. I said, well, what's the persistence problem? And he said, well, that's the fact that, you know, if you were to send them to a distant planet and then send some astronauts up there, these little machines would say, oh, boy, there's iron in the hemoglobin cells in those guys. Let's go eat that.
Yep.
So, in other words, that they can't be turned off or stopped. Is that related to what you're talking about?
Well, it's not unrelated. This is more in the area of nanotechnology, where they talk about nanobots that can be used to build or
so those are more like little machines instead of microbes that are built from the ground up?
Yeah. But there are some parallels as well. But the thing here, I guess, is that it's being used as the excuse for saying that we can convert, we can use our corn or our soybeans as biofuels. And then we don't need to worry about how much biomass we consume for our cars, because we're working towards that point where these microbes will be constructed that will make it all very simple and inexpensive, and we'll have lots of biomass for everybody, so we're not starving people for our cars. That's the theory. It's been around for several years now, and it has yet to work. I mean, some in terms of biofuels, it has yet to work. In terms of other things, it actually is moving into the marketplace already, where they've developed sort of tweaked again existing organisms and made them perform functions differently. They've managed to develop artemisinin, that's sort of a synthetic artemisinin, which is from the Chinese wormwood tree, which is used for combating malaria. They say that they can now, as of just a few days ago, in fact, that they can now develop through synthetic biology this drug that doesn't any longer require the natural plant, and get out around the world. It does, by the way, eliminate the jobs of tens of thousands of farmers who are growing it now, and eliminates those jobs overnight.
Is that what you meant when I heard you say back in the presentation a couple of months ago that these people believe three-quarters of the biomass is there to be had? There
that,
to be tampered with and altered?
That's basically what's behind synthetic biology. It is the assumption that now, in the marketplace, we're using about one quarter of the world's annual terrestrial biomass. It's really part of our consumables and from fields and forests and so on. Which means, again, that three quarters of the world's annual terrestrial biomass has yet to be monopolized by anybody. So synthetic biologists want to be the new biomasters. They want to be the guys who says, okay, we'll find ways that we can manipulate all that other stuff out there in the forests and turn it into, again, whatever products we think at the end of the day might be useful. And the concern here is a bit like the solar radiation management thing in geoengineering. It's quite doable. It can be done. There are, you know, they are making progress. If they'll ever go as far as they think they can go, but we don't know. But we know that there are commercial products being produced now, and there's an awful lot of money going into it. I mean, unlike again geoengineering, which is mainly governments, we've got a lot of the world's biggest corporations that are pursuing synthetic biology. The world's seven biggest pharmaceutical companies, the world's six biggest grain trading companies, the world's six biggest chemical companies, and the world's six biggest energy companies are all heavily invested in synthetic biology.
Mm. So, in a perfect world, what would you see could possibly happen at this point to prevent things from going in a disastrous direction?
Well, it's again an area where the United Nations is looking into it, and both in different fora, in fact, different UN bodies are examining it, and we're hoping that we'll have some progress in the next year or so, where at least, if not a moratorium until the world can kind of catch up and understand what's happening here, at least some kind of rules will be laid down to say that certain things shouldn't be done. We shouldn't be making novel life forms the world's never seen before and throwing them out into nature. I mean, some of the work that's being done now shows that you can have more sort of unnatural genetic diversity in a test tube than you can have of natural genetic or biological diversity in the Amazon. So the ability to construct these novel forms, and who knows what they will actually do when they, as like everything else does, finally do escape from the lab and get out into society, into our fields and our forests and our refrigerators.
Yeah, exactly what I was thinking when you were talking about tampered microbes. Well,
the danger, too, if I just add, is that this can be done by almost anybody now. It's sort of a do-it-yourself kind of approach to, you know, build your own little critter. And because it is so cheap. I mean, the A, the C, the G, and the T that we all learned about in the makeup DNA, that make up the base pairs of life, are just kinds of sugars. And you can buy them online. You can put them into your $400 gene synthesizer. And you can start, with your laptop, you can start to build your own, again, life form. And if you work with a bunch of other people with similar laptops and gene synthesizers, you can paste together or clip together, you know, sequences of DNA that really are living things. And back in 2010, we saw, in fact, that the most amazing thing happened, which was that scientists, for the first time, were actually able to build an entirely artificial life form that was self-replicating, that has never lived before. So, you know, for the first time ever, kind of God has competition. You can build your own, and this is a unique creature that, again, replicates. So I mean, it doesn't exist well outside the lab at this point, but more is being done since then, and we know that, again, these kinds of constructions are really quite credible.
And these companies are also filing patents on metabolic pathways, is that right?
Yes, I mean, one of the really interesting things for them is they've had troubles scaling up to the size of biofuels. I mean, trying to match what fossil fuels can do is a big job. But they've started to look at some of the sort of flavor and fragrance and beverage and vegetable oil sort of markets, which are all biomass, and they've found that they can actually tweak again the metabolic pathways that produce the chemical compounds that we want at the end of the day, for whether it's vanilla or rubber or coffee or citrus or whatever. They can do those sort of in this artificial environment and produce them relatively cheaply compared to the natural product in many cases. And they're applying for patents on that. What's kind of alarming in this case is that there really are about 8 really important metabolic pathways in plants, and they lead to literally hundreds of thousands of final commercial compounds. So the companies are applying for patents that really control the pathway. So everything down that pathway belongs to the company. In developing synthetic biology, and that kind of scope of patent protection is pretty much unheard of. I mean, there are some other worrisome kinds, but this is one of the worst we've ever come across. It gives them an enormous monopoly over biomass.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at this article in the ETC Group magazine. It's the issue that was called "Who Will Control the Economy?" And I don't see a date on it, but anyway, you can see it. Folks could look at the website. There's an article on synthetic biology. There really are quite a lot of big corporations throwing their weight behind this. So everything you said seems to have a lot of inertial momentum, and we know how that works, especially in the United States, when the corporate sector is pushing for something. I want to back up a bit to the genetically modified organisms, and I know ETC Group, that you're the executive director of, is very involved in the Global South in trying to protect people in the agricultural sector from these many developments since the World Trade Organization that are undercutting their livelihood. And I wonder what you think of that story that was in the news the past week about the Brazilian scientists. It was in a peer-reviewed scientific journal showing that the genetically modified organisms were causing damage to mammalian blood cells. And there have been, before that, this recent report showing that the Roundup pesticide, which is now sprayed so much because of the Roundup Ready genetically modified seeds in the United States, so there's now tons of Roundup pesticide, that is having health damages. Do you think this is going to be able to roll back this juggernaut of genetically modified seeds, which have already taken over so much of agri-industry in this country?
It's hard to know. I mean, it goes both ways, because I was in Mexico last week and we had a really alarming situation there where Monsanto and DuPont and Syngenta are promoting genetically modified maize in this corn in the center of diversity for that crop. I mean, corn comes from Mexico and Guatemala. So they're almost literally eradicating the center of genetic diversity for the crop in order to get control of it. So you see that happening on the one side, and on the other side, we hear these stories about pollinators being destroyed because of chemicals that are, again, related to GM crops, and think, well, maybe the world's going to catch on and understand this is a very sloppy technology. It was put together very hastily because of the demands of the marketplace, and it actually just does not work well. It's not good science. But the story out of Brazil that frankly alarms us the most is legislation in the Brazilian Congress right now that is proposing to remove that government's ban on terminator seeds, the seeds that die at harvest time. They're genetically modified. They die at harvest time, so farmers can't grow the seed again.
And they have to buy new seed from the corporation every year.
Every year. Brazil had, back in about almost 10 years ago now, banned the technology, and as have most governments, in fact. It's been very widely opposed around the world and hasn't been put into the marketplace. But the argument in Brazil is that they're developing GM trees, eucalyptus trees especially, they're designed to grow in the Amazon soils, which means that they're going to plow down the Amazon and put up the eucalyptus plantations. But the pollen from the trees spreads so far, it can cause so much damage to other species, that they say they need to use the terminator technology to keep the pollen sterile. And so in the end, we end up with this government saying, one, we're going to plow down the Amazon. Two, we're going to put up eucalyptus plantations and destroy the biodiversity of the Amazon. And three, in order to do all of that terrible stuff, we're going to unleash the terminator technology on the world and on agriculture. And that's got us quite
alone. I can't believe they'd be putting in eucalyptus trees, which, you know, nobody wants to nest in them. They have that very acidic, aromatic. They're tearing them all out in California, for instance, in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. I mean, they made great windbreaks in Australia, but they're not at all helpful to building up habitat. Hospitality and biodiversity.
No, not at all. But they're very profitable. If you can develop GM eucalyptus that are, of course, are fast growing, but also are denser than before, and actually are higher and wider than before, and that's what they say they're developing. But they acknowledge that because there is a danger that the GM material will contaminate other species and so on, that they just feel, darn it, they got just plain obliged to use this technology that will mean farmers can't save seed any longer.
Well, this has been like being in a bad science fiction movie for an hour, I must say, Pat. But I'm so glad that you are on the front lines here, getting this information out and taking all the effective actions that ETC Group has taken. So, again, I would like to refer listeners to your website, which has got so many great things, and especially the magazine. It's got a nice layout. It's easy to read. It's even amusing in places. Highly recommended, ETC Group's magazine. That's all the time we have, but I want to thank you so much for coming on the program.
No, thank you for having me.
Okay, well, let's walk on over to the Arts Corner, and for our poem this week, I figured we'd really need to hear something about the earth. This poem is Sleeping in the Woods by Mary Oliver. It opens with her homage to William Blake's poems, that series he called Songs of Innocence. This is Sleeping in the Woods. Sleeping in the Forest, excuse me. I thought the earth remembered me. She took me back so tenderly, arranging her dark skirts, her pockets full of lichens and seeds. I slept as never before, a stone on the riverbed, nothing between me and the white fire of the stars. but my thoughts, and they floated, light as moths, across the branches of the perfect trees. All night I heard the small kingdoms breathing around me, the insects and the birds who do their work in the darkness. All night I rose and fell as if in water, grappling with a luminous doom. By morning I had vanished at least a dozen times into something better. So that was Mary Oliver. And for our song, well, since we were speaking with a guest from Canada today, we'll hear a song from Kate and Anna McGarrigle. This is Complaint pour Sainte-Catherine, a Quebecois song about walking along la rue de Sainte-Catherine in Montreal, with a refrain in it that keeps saying, we've been doing politics for 20 years. Yeah, or more, I'd say. Here it is. McGarrigle singing lead vocals, and the late Kate McGarrigle with Complaint pour Sainte-Catherine. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest, Susan Colin Marks, Senior Vice President of Search for Common Ground, talking about their international work in conflict resolution. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Ashoka Bandaraj, author of Sustainability and Well-Being. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Now that we know it, let's really show it.